Welcome, I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Tonight, we're going to talk about the opioid crisis ravaging our country, and more generally, the problem of addiction, which so many people struggle with. More than 130 people a day die from opioid-related drug overdoses. And studies indicate that one in three Americans, including me, have been touched in some way by addiction and the death and destruction that it brings. Our guest tonight is here to share how his experience in ministering to people suffering from drug addictions transitioned from treatment to prevention, with the help of the Holy Eucharist and an innovative computer algorithm. Here to tell us more about it, please welcome Michael Vasquez. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, Father. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for doing the work you're doing. This is very important to me. One of my closest relatives died from fentanyl poisoning, taking one thing and died from it, not realizing it. And this is something that, the nation deals with, whether it's the poisoning or people seeking out various opioids. It's a very, very serious problem. And with our open borders, a lot of illegal fentanyl is being imported, and about 100,000 people a year are dying from it. It's a tremendous, tremendous problem and grave evil. So what exactly is it that you are doing, and how did you get into all this?
Father, it started when I was young, and coming home from school one day, I found my mother overdosed on the floor of our kitchen. Mm-hmm. Didn't really realize what it was, because I think I was too young to deal with it.
Sure.
But then we started dealing with that, and she'd been a nurse and had broken her back at work, got addicted to morphine, and because she was a nurse, had access to it.
Sure.
And so from that it evolved, and as I grew older, I know my father, there wasn't the internet back then, so my father really had to learn how to deal with it, but at that time it was a mental health issue. You were institutionalized as opposed to going to treatment.
Yes.
And so as I got older and I got into, my career started, and I had a successful software career, and I had just sold a company when my oldest son and his best friend got involved with drugs. And it was because, like everybody listening, when you start to accept unreasonable thinking and unreasonable actions, you don't realize it, but you're enabling them. Mm-hmm. And I think as we enabled him, it got out of hand, and we were able to, at that point, after selling the company, we realized we've been blessed with some resources and time, and that maybe we should try to help. And that was really how we got started. And we started a treatment program, but really didn't see any programs that we felt were as effective as we should be working with. Mm-hmm. So we decided to start with a white piece of paper and then step back and said, where do we go from here? And we really got to the human person and decided maybe our Catholic faith was a good place to start.
Why would you connect that? What was it that led you to connect the role of our faith in dealing with drug issues?
Well, as we looked at the addiction, mm-hmm. you saw that what happens was, and as the Beatitudes, the Catechism talks about in the Beatitudes, that we all by human nature want to be happy or satisfied. Now, at the end of the day, obviously only God can provide that. But what happens is from the natural aspect, we get our satisfaction from our living, working, or relationship environments. Are we happy with our self-image? Are we happy with our career? Are we happy with our relationships? When I don't get that satisfaction naturally, I then look to see, because human nature kicks in, to try to drive me to be satisfied. And at that point, I look for artificial means to create that satisfaction. Could be made up of hoarding, shopping, eating, obviously pornography, drugs, or alcohol. And by doing that, then what happens is that artificial satisfaction never really provides true satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And it creates stress, anxiety, depression. And at that point, it starts to create a chemical imbalance in the body. And that chemical imbalance is because the body has its own natural endorphins to help deal with stress, anxiety, and depression. And during the addiction period, the body really becomes depleted. So you don't have those natural sources to deal with the stress, anxiety, and depression. So again, you not only are using these artificial means for satisfaction, but you're actually looking at dealing with the other things that come with that as far as dealing with the elements of your body chemistry, which is really broken into your nutrition, your activity, and your sleep, unique enough. So we started looking at building a program, we knew it needed to be built around those elements, kind of the mind, body, and soul.
And I think, as I understand it, when people get addicted to booze, drugs, pornography, gambling, shopping, all these different things, that it does release endorphins without making them satisfied. There's no interior peace. And so that's what they're looking to replenish with opioids, the endorphins.
What happens is the opioid in the miracle of the pharmaceutical industry exactly mimics what an endorphin molecule looks like. Mm-hmm. So when it attaches to the brain's receptor, the brain and the body thinks it has an oversupply of endorphins, so it starts to excrete those. Obviously then when the opioid washes away and the body calls on that again, it's actually depleted.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what really creates the craving for a drug. If you've heard the term craving,
yes.
and it's really that depletion because the body's screaming out, and it puts the body into what we call withdrawal. And withdrawal is the body screaming out for that opioid, and the way it does that is it makes you sick. I'm going to make you nauseated until you give me an opioid. I'm going to not let you sleep until you give me an opioid. And there's hundreds and hundreds of those medical conditions. And that's really what we looked at, is by recognizing that, and we started dealing with it to help rebuild mm-hmm. both the mind and the body, but then we had to deal with the soul.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is very helpful, because a lot of times it's from the outside, looking in on an addicted person, that it seems, well, just make a decision, do something, choose to, and there's this physical reality that, you know, they really don't have control over until they go through that stage of withdrawal and start getting back into a healthier way of rebuilding their own endorphins. Would that be correct?
And the opioids create a unique problem. And that problem is the fact that most people use opioids, as they abuse them, to feel normal because of those withdrawal symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is a very low percentage of people get help. There's an estimated 2 to 3 million people a year that are addicted to opioids, but only 20 to 30% ever get help, because of the fact that if I'm using it to feel normal, when I try to talk to you to get help, you seem normal, you talk normal, and you can convince me that you really don't need help. And the problem is then, because of those withdrawal symptoms, only about 50% of the people who finally get help actually remain sober because of that chemical imbalance
mm-hmm.
not being corrected. And so when we decided to really approach and complete the circle on what we were delivering, my wife, Rosemarie, went to the bishop, and she shared our vision with him. And he did some amazing things. He allowed us, number one, to hire a priest full-time on staff. So if you can imagine, with the shortage of priests, they ended up helping us to bring a priest in from Ghana, and that was the first step. He then allowed us to build chapels in all of our facilities, came and blessed them, and then put the Blessed Sacrament in every chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously with the sanctuary light, that they knew that God was present. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, we started with daily Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had Mass daily. And then Rosemarie went to the Mother Superior at the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Rockford, Illinois, and was able to get a group of nuns to come to our facilities. And we converted a building on our property as a convent.
Okay.
So what happens is then patients saw every day we were dealing with the mind and the body, going through those chemical reactions and the rebuilding the mind. But we also then at that point, these people saw every day that there were people praying for them, regardless of their religion and regardless of their beliefs, but there were priests, nuns, and staff praying for their recovery every day. And that's really how we started to evangelize through our actions and through what we built for them to experience. And the results were amazing.
Yeah, and this is not your attempt to sneak in the chance to make them become Catholic.
No.
That's not what you're doing. You're focusing on their drug addiction, and yet Catholicism, living the Catholic faith with a focus on Jesus Christ present in the Blessed Sacrament, that is a key element of the therapy.
We decided we'd stay true to our faith and that alone, and then we could really count on, we had to reach out to do the work mentally and physically, mm-hmm. but the Eucharist really did the heavy lifting for us mm-hmm. as we were there. And so, again, the results were amazing, but it still felt a bit constricted because we could only help so many people. As I said earlier, there are 2 to 3 million people in the world, in the U.S., who need help with opioids, with a small percentage getting help. And we felt like we were limited because we were a sliver of that. We were helping 700 or 800 people a year, and we knew there were more that needed help. Mm-hmm. And so what we decided to do is, what if we could flip the script, and instead of letting these people become addicted and then go in and try and rebuild their character, rebuild their life, what if we could prevent them from ever getting there? Mm-hmm. And that really became our mission, and we started a company. It's called Opioid Clinical Management, built on the algorithms, as you mentioned earlier in the mm-hmm. introduction, mm-hmm. with the idea of taking all these indicators that we had documented over 12 years that were showing that this patient, it's interesting because patients, as they progress to addiction, actually show the same medical issues as they come off of addiction. And we had thousands of documented cases of patients coming off of addiction. So we were able to reverse engineer that and build an algorithm that then allowed us to spider through paid claims in a health system and actually identify the patients who are going to have a problem with an opioid, and then at that point, intervene.
What do you mean spider through?
So the software actually looks and scans all of the claims, and it's looking for certain patterns. And it's looking for the patterns of what these withdrawal symptoms look like
okay.
as the patient suffers them. And when it identifies that, interestingly enough, it segregates that patient and scrapes, because inside of every medical claim is the doctor's ID of who's writing that prescription and allowing it to continue. Because keep in mind, if we're preventing this, we really don't know who the patients are. So we have a 10,000 member client that's a teacher's union, and we've been able to reduce opioid prescribing 70% inside of that union, and the teachers still don't know that we're installed because we've never talked to a teacher, we've never identified a teacher, because we've been able to do this totally through approaching the physicians and showing them how they can change the delivery of care as opposed to change how they manage care, how they practice medicine, because you would never ask a physician to change how they practice medicine. So an example of that, physicians always are going to make you aware, they're cognizant and aware that this opioid could be dangerous. And if you continue
sure,
with it and
sure.
I refill this prescription.
They have a legal as well as moral obligation to let you know, here are the risks in taking the opioid I'm about to prescribe.
Right. And so what we did was we showed them that, and again, physicians at the end of the day want better outcomes for their patients.
Sure.
That's their compassion, that's their mission.
Sure.
And so what we showed them is the fact that you don't need to change how you practice medicine, but by us going through the claims, we can identify some patients who aren't responding probably the way you'd like them to, and we think we can help you do that. The way we do that is show you how you deliver care, not how you practice medicine. What's that mean? By the way, that let's say we sit down and we talk about the risks of opioids, continuing to keep them may be a risk to your life, your health, or everything. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, most people, because we had dealt with thousands of patients inside of an opioid treatment center, usually goes in one ear and out the other. Mm-hmm. They take it because the chemistry is starting to react in their body and the craving. But however, we found through research that if we documented that discussion in a contract, and actually had the patient sign it and have the physician sign it, that most patients will actually decide to discontinue that opioid if they don't need it. Because what happens is, opioids are, you have to have a pain diagnosis to be able to prescribe opioids. So you have a pain event, mm-hmm. and then the physician prescribes the opioid to manage that pain until you can get back to normal daily living.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the intent. And so what happens is then, as the physicians explain this to the patient, half will decide that, you know what, maybe this is the time I could discontinue, because what happens, in dependency, in addiction, is patients surpass when that opioid is actually managing pain, and it's now managing the withdrawal symptom. It's crossed over where you could have regained or gone back to normal daily living, but you're continuing to use it, and that's where the indications of addiction start.
Yeah, okay. So is this approach, where you go to the physicians, is this then working pretty well?
We've had, interestingly enough, I'll take the example of that teachers union that I just spoke of, 95% of the physicians we approached embraced it and implemented it, because we get no results if the physicians won't embrace it, because that's how we get the what's called a brief intervention. It's kind of like a pause to think, okay, do I really need to refill this? And if I don't, maybe this would be a good time to stop. Mm-hmm. And I could get by with ibuprofen, I could get by with physical therapy. So by showing the doctors that this isn't anything that's being done intentional, it's an added tool that you can add. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, what I just described, and there's 10 of those, what I call brief interventions that we interject into the process, several states, in our state, being from Iowa, it's actually a law. So the legislature recognized that these brief interventions are critical, and they made it a legislative law that the physicians need to do it. Now, is it enforced? Not from the aspect you'd think of that, because it's civil, but what you find is most pain management associations, medical associations, even the CDC supports all of these, but nobody's ever really made the physician aware of it because of the fact it's very difficult to link the opioid and how it's being prescribed to linking it to that illness. Because what happens with opioids is you're given that opioid, as I talked about, to manage the pain. Uniquely, in the miracle of the body, it starts to heal. And because it's healing, I start to become very inconsistent in how I take my opioid. Unique to that drug, because if I'm on a congestive heart failure drug or a diabetes drug, I tend to be more consistent. Mm-hmm. But with opioids, I get up this morning, my hip doesn't feel too bad, so I'll skip it. And then by lunch, I'm busy, I can't take it. And by dinner, my hip is killing me, but also that little, I take my opioid, but that little twang of anxiety goes away at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's the uniqueness of the mix of a prescription and the way the body heals that really has created this process. And so what we found is, when we did our research, is as patients walked into opioid detox centers, 75% of them reported that they started with a prescription written by their doctor, and in most cases paid for by their insurance company.
That confirms most of what I've known of people who got into opioid addiction, prescribed by the doctor, and then gets out of control.
Right, and it's not intentional. It's because of the fact that they haven't laid the groundwork of this delivery, the complete complex delivery, as opposed to just obviously providing care and responding, because most physicians have a goal of satisfaction and comfort. I want to make sure you're comfortable so you're satisfied with care. And by not neglecting, but not being aware that if they just were more diligent in completing this documentation, which become brief interventions, it puts that pause for you to sit back and think, maybe this is a good time for me to stop, as opposed to, as I talked about in that union, everybody who discontinued made the unilateral decision themselves to discontinue. They didn't come to the practice, the physician's office that day, and were denied access to it. So that's one of the real values of what we do. If you need a pain pill, you don't think twice about signing a contract because you need the pill. However, being educated on the risks, and maybe are you at that cusp, this would be a good time to stop. Yeah. And so that's really that brief intervention that to get you to pause and think and then make a decision on your own with some of the help of the education of the providers. And so we've had amazing, we have 1,700 small employers who use this tool every day to make sure that their employees are not, and their family members are not progressing. And across that entire install base, we've had 95% acceptance by the providers because we're approaching them to help get better outcomes, which I don't know many physicians who don't want that.
Yeah. I think we still have situations where people very much need the kind of help you were talking about at the beginning, where they are addicted and we have to help them work toward it, but preventing it in the first place for that 75% who are not some kid hanging out on a street corner. It's a middle-aged person with a hip replacement or a knee replacement and other very legitimate, you know, medical needs. This is there to give them pain relief, and it becomes another kind of problem.
And the unique piece about opioids, again, is the fact that it doesn't provide, later in stage during addiction, a euphoric effect. Most people will continue with their opioid to feel normal, yeah, as I said earlier.
Yeah.
Where most other drugs, abused or addictive drugs, have a euphoric effect, so you more readily see the effect of that drug because,
yes,
you're not acting normal.
Right.
As opposed to on an opioid, you're actually acting normal, so it's more difficult to identify it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the most famous, I think this would apply, one of those famous cases that was out there was Rush Limbaugh, who had gotten addicted to Oxycontin, mm-hmm, after he had a very much needed surgery.
Right.
But then, you know, this sounds like the same kind of process had gone on with him.
Yeah, and one of our goals is to be more prevalent across the country, but with the idea in the impact of the fentanyl crisis, obviously what we're doing to prevent this doesn't deal with the counterfeit side of fentanyl, because,
yes,
that's the deadly, illegal piece.
Yeah.
However, there is a track of people who have had an injury, had a surgery, went through pain management, and didn't feel like the opioid was giving them enough relief, and then they progressed to fentanyl. But obviously, sometimes managed, sometimes not, mm-hmm, and then it has a drastic end to it. And so our goal is to be prevalent enough across the country to where we can at least prevent that track, so that the legal system hopefully can intervene and deal with the interdiction of counterfeit fentanyl, which is, you know, obviously in our young people is killing
yeah,
everyone.
Yeah, it's with the fentanyl coming across the border, people are finding, oh, that's, I don't even need a prescription, it's real cheap, I can just get some of that. And it's not well measured, it's not controlled in a scientific way, it's the elements are brought from China, they're put right together in Mexico and smuggled across the border. And you don't know if you're getting a dosage that is deadly or not.
Right.
And sometimes it's also included in marijuana. They'll put some of that in a shipment of marijuana to give it a better high so customers come back. But again, the what they give you is not well measured. It's not evenly distributed, say, in the marijuana. And you die. I think they say that with the fentanyl, that the amount of fentanyl that fits on the nose of Abraham Lincoln on a penny, it can be enough to kill you.
Or multiple people.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah. I mean, it's extraordinarily dangerous. And I know it strikes me as very odd,
yeah,
that so much of this is coming across. And, you know, my dad sold used cars for a number of years. And if he was selling cars that killed off his customers, it hurt business. I mean, he depended on repeat business. People kept coming back because he was honest and they trusted him. To sell a product that kills your best customers doesn't make sense.
No.
There's something, I think there's another element from the drug cartels interested in killing people, or careless, certainly. But it's a very serious problem to lose, you know, just in the last 3 years, you know, more than 250,000 people, close to 100,000.
You know, we live in an interesting time because, as you're aware, there was an opioid settlement done where up to and over $36 billion has been now interjected into states, counties, and cities to be utilized for one of two reasons, either prevention or treatment. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we can't treat our way out of this. We can't build our way out of this because there aren't enough treatment beds. And it's not just the physical brick and mortar. There isn't enough human capital to be able to deliver quality care to deal with that. So we have to lay the groundwork for a prevention solution to be able to, to do this, because if we can't cut down on that flow, then at that point it'll get out of control and it could be the downfall of entire generations of people. It already is of kids 18 to 24, and so
number one killer of people 18 to 24.
Yeah,
and you know, and again, it seems like that there are these two very distinct groups. That 75% of people who get addicted to opioids are just getting it from their medical doctors.
Right.
That's what you're trying to prevent.
Right. Right. We think that'll get the cusp of it, because it really gets to a point where by those people using it for what it's intended, a pain event, manage the pain till I can get back to normal daily living, and this discontinue. And most people are able to do that. Mm-hmm. If they have a balance, what we find is if you're in that point of chemical imbalance and that pain event happens, you're more susceptible to become addicted. If you've got the stress, anxiety going on in your life, if mm-hmm. you don't have a good balanced life of 8 hours of sleep, 30 minutes of activity, balanced carbs and protein, we find that you become a little more, you're more susceptible. So that's the first thing we did. Interestingly, in our treatment program, probably the biggest question we got asked as people left the program is, where did we buy our mattresses? Because they had never slept so well
in
their
right?
life. So,
wow, it's amazing. That really is an amazing outcome. Because one of the things that we see advertised a lot is mattresses, pills, and all kinds of pillows, all kinds of things to help you sleep better.
Yeah.
That's become a major industry, but it may well be related to some of this other problem as well.
Right, it's critical to rebuild that. And again, it's a health message. Obviously, the more healthy you can be when you're being prescribed an opioid, the better effect you'll have. You won't be one of that in that percentage of people who become dependent or addicted.
Yeah, and this is something for us to work on all these levels, to find folks who can help the folks that are addicted, and that Eucharistic Christ-centered healing approach is very important. Hmm. But the preventive is more essential, it seems.
And if I don't know if you connected the dots, but the entire algorithm was developed from the data we gathered from those experiences that we had with those patients in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that data really was the premise of how the algorithm could work and uniquely find patients who were progressing, because we understood what they looked like medically mm-hmm. as they came off of opioids.
Mm-hmm. So in one sense, even their pain became something of a gift that was able to help others avoid getting into that addiction and pain. This is a good example of the suffering being made redemptive,
right?
By saying, okay, we learned from this, now we can go forward to help be more preventive.
Yeah, and we think that's how that model that we built, that was supported by the Eucharist and everything that we put around it, allowed us to get data elements that I don't think really existed prior. That's why we have unique vision. We have a patent filed because of just the unique way we've approached it. Very complex problem, but it's a simple solution.
Sure. And it's a solution that affects so many elements. I mean, the ramifications of not dealing with the opioid addiction has great effects psychologically, physically, spiritually, socially. All of these parts of being human get disrupted by the opioid addiction. And they break down, and sometimes in the people affected by opioid addiction, it can create a need for others to get into their own addictions and mental problems.
And it becomes a big issue for employers, for people in their careers, because it's not, once you see the 2 to 3 million people who are addicted, that's truly not what we're talking about. We're talking about that progression, because it starts to affect your family life. You become abusive. It affects your finances. And so we didn't see a person who came in our center who hadn't ruined their finances, and then obviously all their relationships. I think the one commonality among people who walked in our front door, the thousands of people who walked in our front door, was lost hope. And that was really our driving factor, was try to give that hope back. Yeah. And that was the heart of what we would see as they left, as they'd regained that hope.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a little break right now, but if you want to find out more about Michael Vasquez's work in opioid abuse prevention, you can go to his website, which is Michael-Vasquez, and that's V-A-S-Q-U-E-Z, Michael-Vasquez.com. While you're there, you can also see and get his book, The Untold Story of the Opioid Crisis in American Healthcare, A New Era of Prevention Through AI, Artificial Intelligence. So this would be a very good thing to take a look at. Again, it's hard to, realize, but families all over the country are dealing with this. We all need to work on that as well. We'll be back in a couple minutes with your questions and comments, so please stay with us. Welcome back, and we're dealing with Michael Vasquez and the work that he's doing to prevent, especially opioid addiction, and help people out of their addictions as well. Two different aspects of a very serious problem, both of which must be tackled, given the large number of people in our society who have different kinds of addictions. Let's start off with some questions. You ready for that?
I am, Father.
Let's start off with Linda in the great state of New York. Linda, what can we do for you today?
Hi, Father. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. Hope you're doing well also.
Yes. I come from a family that has a few addictions. I have a nephew who died of a heroin overdose, and he has brother who's an alcoholic. My sister took him in to be homeless because he basically was supporting him across the country. He can't hold a job because of the drinking, and we've been praying for him for years. Anyway, there's anything I realize what you're working on is people with drug addiction. Alcoholism seems to be pretty prevalent these days. Is there anything else that we can, she supports him if he's not drinking, abusive?
Yeah, Linda, I think you might have your TV on in the background.
No, it's not. No?
Interesting, because your phone is fading in and out. But I think we got the gist of what you're saying. So these some members of your family who have these addictions, a number of them, you've been praying for a long time. What else do you do in addition to praying?
The big point that I want to make in the beginning is what we're talking about this evening and what we do is prevention. because there's a large network of treatment, both social services, private, public treatment programs, and we didn't just want to be another one of those, even though we had built our our program around that. So if the family member is already addicted, you really need to interject them into community programs that are designed, and you probably already have, and that's the frustration I think I hear in her voice, is the fact that so many people are overlooked and they aren't helped by that. But that's not what we do. We really are designed to prevent that the next person through the door from seeing the same experience as your family member.
Right, but if, you know, she's dealing with the situation where they are addicted, what are the kind of places they can go for help? I know here in Alabama, we have a Chinakalo community. In fact, it was started by a nun, Sister Elvira. And Sister Elvira was here. I interviewed her some years ago. How does that work and some of these other programs work that people can get into?
A lot of it will be driven by availability in your community, access to resources, and then reaching out. So what we found is there are nonprofits that provide treatment. We even, at one point during our program, operated a program inside of a jail so that people that were, because you may not be aware, 70% of people in American jails, now not prisons, but jails actually would meet the medical criteria for addiction, not because they were in jail because of a drug possibly, but because what they did illegally was to support a drug habit and addiction.
Yes. Yes.
So there's programs designed for people. Yeah, I think you mentioned either homeless or addiction, and I think you have to use the community resources to try to reach out to get them that help, because that's where I would start. If you have the finances, there's private companies around the U.S. In almost every state has one, and or if there's insurance, which it sounds like there may not be, but that's really the challenge I think people face when they, because this is an addiction, you typically ruin your finances, and so you're looking for that sort of help. But that's where I would start, the social services, community services in your town or city or state.
And there is also Narcotics Anonymous, and as well as Alcoholics Anonymous, and there are, which is a 12-step program that focuses on dealing with God. You know, it's essentially dealing with God, and God dealing with that person and meeting that person. And they have them for a wide variety of addicted behaviors, Gamblers Anonymous, Shopping Anonymous, pornography issues, all of the Sex Anonymous, all of these different groups, because people, you know, need God, and a very important part of for those who are already addicted is the 12-step program. And, you know, it doesn't cost anything. It's not like they charge you. They're totally free. And your prayer, as well as helping them into a spiritual program, this would be something very useful to them. So that would be another approach as well. We have a question from our studio audience. Sir, where are you from?
Norfolk, Virginia.
Good to have you here. Welcome. And your question or comment?
Question is, the data is based on the insured people. There are a lot of uninsured people that's also homeless, that's also addicted to opioid, and their best access and easy access is going through the emergency room. And they basically hang out at the emergency room until they're given the opioid that they want. Is there any program or any idea to reach out to the government to kind of help them out?
I think almost the same answer that Father just gave is going to be applicable to that population. Using both, if resources are an issue, reaching out to programs that are free in your community, 12-step, and those, And then reaching out also to, if they're in an emergency room or they've been admitted, they typically have social services or refer you to community services to try and get that help. And that's probably where they would need to start.
Yeah, and I think that might be also an area where, you know, your program can reach the emergency room. It's one thing to deal with family physicians and others where there's a relationship, but for the homeless whose primary care comes from an emergency room, this would be another group of medical staff who might also benefit from, you know, understanding this preventive thing. They don't have an ongoing relationship with most of the homeless.
No.
But they are dealing with them, and they oftentimes come to them already long addicted. This is a key component of being homeless, oftentimes mentally unstable to begin with, and oftentimes addicted, but not always. And then there are others who are homeless as well, but those two form a big, big chunk, if not the majority, of our homeless population.
Right, and another category of that are really our veterans. And so, and the key thing for our algorithm to be effective, and not in that case specifically of individuals, is the fact that the VA has centralized data that then we can help, because then their doctors are prescribing. Now, they're not using it, but they need to be aware of the fact that there is a prevention tool out there that could help the veteran population, which then transitions into portions of our homeless population.
It does. It does. Yeah, that'd be helpful. We have another caller. Hello, Steve in North Carolina?
Yes. Mr. Vasquez, I just want to show my frustration also. 12 years ago, I broke my back at work. I worked for a fleet company, and I've got two rods and eight screws on my back, and I've been on pain meds ever since. And I need these to function. I just irritate me to no end that the people that go into these pain clinics or emergency rooms and ask pain meds, whether it's hydro or oxy, and then go out and sell it. Meanwhile, guys like me walk into a pain clinic, and they look at me like I have to prove my innocence before they give me what I need. It's been a struggle to get everything I need so where I can function. Because I don't need to get high. I've got enough pleasure, yeah. But I'm just frustrated with all these people that take advantage of the system.
Sure. Sorry about your own difficulties there. What about that situation where people do try to game the system? What have you learned about that kind of circumstance?
Well, I think also to answer Steve's question, the idea that it's going to be really based on his pain management doctor. Mm-hmm. And those doctors are specialists in designing, and apparently it hasn't been effective, it sounds like. But the idea that you have to rely on them to let and be aware and communicate that the pain medication isn't working to the level that he'd like it to be. And if it's actually not working, then obviously look for a different avenue to pursue.
Mm-hmm. And for those who, again, he feels concerned with, the people who are using the system to get drugs, what can be done about that?
Well, just recently, every state in the country has a state drug database that's designed to measure and manage opioid prescribing. Missouri was the last state in the country to get it. They just got it a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that's designed to be a safety net, at least, for that. But it's not comprehensive enough to deal with to identify early intervention, but it is designed to just limit prescribing under certain guidelines. And so that's one of the things state governments have done. And then the intent is hopefully, again, as I've said before, that these opioid settlement funds are used to help deal with these sort of situations, create programs that outreach to the homeless, to those that are suffering long-term chronic, you know, what he's talking about is chronic pain that is a different, some sort of a different animal, because you really have a chemical dependency, but you have pain. Yeah. And that's the challenge they face. And hopefully these funds that the states are receiving are used for programs just like what Steve would want or need.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have another question from our studio audience. Ma'am, where are you from?
Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Good to have you here. Thank you very much. And your question?
So my question is, I work in the hospital. So we have patients who come in for surgery, you know, back surgery, hip surgery, and all that. So would your program be able to deal with this at the start, because it's prevention? So they go for surgery, and then they get discharged. Would the program be successful with this situation?
It actually would be an extension. So what let's say the example I think you're saying is that a patient comes to a hospital, has a surgery, and then is discharged. They have a physician who's going to care for them after they're discharged, and that physician will have a protocol to help that patient manage through pain. And it's where our software helps that physician be more aware of how they're delivering care, as I've mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. and that awareness then helps get a better outcome to where the patient can get through the surgery, manage the pain, and then get back to normal daily living, which was the goal. So it really will be reliant more on the physician providing care after discharge than on the hospital, because they won't come back to the hospital to refill their prescription. And quite frankly, a lot of times they don't even come back to their surgeon. They'll get the initial prescription, and then they'll go back to their orthopedic or whatever specialist is taking care of them long-term, and that'd be our focus, is helping that physician.
So yeah, they usually get discharged with prescriptions, and then after that runs out, they go to their primary, and that's when they get refill for
right.
prescriptions.
Right, yeah. And it's making sure that those refills aren't done unnecessarily, the dosage isn't being increased mm-hmm. unnecessarily, and then systems that track to make sure, because when people overuse, they go to multiple doctors or they go to multiple pharmacists to try to get those prescriptions filled.
And I would wonder whether the primary care doctor who continues to prescribe this is in much contact with the orthopedist or the surgeon that did this. And it doesn't seem that, you know, they would, I doubt that there would be an ongoing conversation with each other.
And that's where the medical record becomes very critical in understanding the transition. Mm-hmm. So after the surgery and the patient is discharged, kind of their process, type of surgery, obviously who the specialist that'll take care of them, mm-hmm. or their primary care. What we find in our network of clients is that primarily family practice, general practitioners, internal medicine physicians don't have the experience to identify this delivery of care shortcoming, mm-hmm. and they are the most responsive mm-hmm. to it. Where specialists who have been trained in pain management, surgeons, pain specialists, are a little more cognizant of that, and we find that there's less need for training there. But there's hundreds of thousands of those family practice type of doctors in the U.S.
Yes. Yeah. We have another caller. We have Steve in the great state of Oregon. Steve, what can we do for you?
Yes, Father. I was just saying that there are a lot of people who have abstained from drugs for many years and all of a sudden have relapsed back into this. What causes that?
Good question.
I would think it'd be a mix, and I actually consider that a separate episode, as opposed to, you're almost alluding to, Steve, that it's a continuation. It was inactive, or it was not something, and then it sort of evolved or rekindled. Something that when they become re-addicted, their life changed by some event, and that event could be completely unrelated to their original addiction, mm-hmm. but yet their lifestyle may still create that challenge, and it may be the lifestyle that caused the original addiction. However, by continuing that, and I think I'd look at that, but it's not explainable, because there are people that believe that you just are predisposed to have an addictive type of personality. Mm-hmm. And what we find more is the fact that sometimes the lifestyle, now there is genetics, I'm not going to deny that, because right. metabolizing opioids are different for every person. However, that addictive event that happened years after a prior event may not be related at all. It may be more related to what caused that original pain, because as you may know, you have to have a pain diagnosis first by a physician to be able to prescribe an opioid.
Mm-hmm. And somebody who's may have had a pain diagnosis, got addicted, got off, but then a completely different situation becomes, as they call it, a trigger mm-hmm. for the person to say, I need to get this. How would they start to get the opioid if it's a completely different situation?
Well, they'd have to be prescribed, so they'd have to be diagnosed. So let's say a car accident 10 years ago, and now all of a sudden a slip and fall, mm-hmm. they would have gone to the physician and gotten a new diagnosis and then a prescription totally unrelated to the car accident, mm-hmm. but to the mm-hmm. slip and fall. Mm-hmm. And then they'd be on that pain management track to mm-hmm. try to get to manage the pain to get them to normal daily living.
And if they did that, to go back to what you had said before, I think dealing with Steve's question is if they're, you know, endorphins are being drained out and they want to feel that again. I mean, that's just a process that has nothing to do with the first time right. at all. It's just that this event drained the endorphins and now I want to use, I think I need something mm-hmm. to keep me feeling normal in regard to endorphins. I'm craving them as I go through this withdrawal, and so I just got to get back to it. Mm-hmm. And it's just a totally distinct event causing the loss of endorphins and the craving for them.
Typically, what we see, though, is it's an event in your life unrelated to the injury. Mm-hmm. So let's say, and it's just kind of where it happens at that wrong time. It's kind of the luck of the draw mm-hmm. to where maybe I'm going through stress in my job, in my relationship, I now am seeing that stress, anxiety, and depression starting to trickle down to where it's getting my chemical imbalance, and then all of a sudden I have a car accident, mm-hmm. and I become more susceptible, where 3 years later, earlier, I may not have had that same issue, even with the same car accident, mm-hmm. because everything else was going fine. Now that's, again, as you try to define it, there's anomalies and you know, alternatives to every answer, but that's really the heart of what we looked at as people came in is what's going on, number one, in your life that's causing this, and number two, how do we eliminate it and get you back to the best version of yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's going to be something that, again, go back to the beginning, it will entail all these aspects of dealing with your social life, your spiritual life, psychologically, all these factors need to be put back in balance
right.
by balanced behavior, like sleep, etc. Yeah, if you want to find out more about Michael Vasquez's work in opioid abuse prevention, you just, again, go to his website. It's michael-vasquez.com, michael-vasquez.com. Vasquez is V-A-S-Q-U-E-Z. You can also get his book, The Untold Story of the Opioid Crisis in American Healthcare, New Era of Prevention Through AI. That's available at that website as well. Thank you, Michael, for coming all the way from Iowa and being with us to share this extremely important problem that is ongoing. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Father.
And we appreciate all of you. Thank you for being with us tonight. And may the good Lord bless you and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you. And may he lead you in all of your ways by his peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. You know, we can bring you this important program and all of our other programs only because this network is brought to you by you. Mother Angelica was inspired in that direction by our Lord. So we ask you, as always, keep us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill, and we'll be able to pay our bills too. Thank you, and God bless.